As we have on the board, and before I do that, I just want to say thanks to Tim Cleary from Institute of Creation Research, who's here. Tim and I have corresponded over the last few months, and I'm glad to get to meet him. He's a geologist as well, and we share that passion of not only geology, but also trying to utilize our knowledge from an apologetic standpoint, a defense of the truth. And obviously, when you look at the science world out there, there's a lot of competing ideas out there, especially with regard to origins, creation versus evolution, and things of that nature. And Tim spent some time with that, and I appreciate his efforts and appreciate getting to work with him at times. This afternoon, though, for a little bit, I want to share with you what to me is one of the most compelling pieces of proof from a faith standpoint, at least with regard to my life. This particular account I want to share with you today had a really meaningful impact to me, even in the university level, whenever professors would counter, obviously, with evolutionary discussion, and one being from a faith standpoint, understanding creation, as the biblical account shows. One professor challenged me and said, show me where the Bible is more factual than what science is teaching today. And so I spent some time looking at that because of a particular class assignment. I decided to look into the hydrologic cycle because I knew there were scriptures about the hydrologic cycle, and not to say that the Bible is a science text, but I knew that they were accurate. But I also knew science had some problems with this, and the more I researched it, the more I realized science just flat had it wrong for much of our history. And in fact, only in the last few hundred years did they ever get it right. But the Bible had it right for a very long time. And that really stood out as a very strong argument for me why the Bible is inspired, and why I could put my faith in the scriptures and therefore put faith in many other things. And so it's not just one thing to put our faith in, but it is one thing that supports much of the foundation of which we have learned through the years, whether it's fulfilled prophecy, whether it's just the uniqueness and the continuity of the scriptures. Many things obviously support it. And so this one is one I want to share with you, and I'm going to really show a comparison, starting with science, how science came to understand this process, the hydrologic cycle, which is also known as the water cycle, and how we understand it today, how we got to that understanding, so that way we have at least a frame of reference from a science standpoint. And then I want to get into the scriptures and show you how marvelous the scriptures really show this to be and has been factual for many, many years. Well, the hydrologic cycle, what is it? Well, it's something we take for granted, something we all learned probably at an early age, and it's how water really processes and cycles on the earth. And that's why it's called a cycle. It's constantly in motion. Sometimes the motion may be very slow, but sometimes it's pretty rapid. And it has a lot to do with a number of components, such as, and it's hard to see back here, is there any chance we can kill that light? Thank you, brother. It starts with the ocean over here on the right. This is a USGS a depiction of that. And obviously evaporation and transpiration off of the land surface ultimately puts moisture in the atmosphere. Today we feel a lot of it moving, obviously, high humidity. But it's ultimately water is supplied from the oceans. It makes its way into the clouds, into the atmosphere, and then it comes back down as precipitation. Many different forms of that, mostly rain, but snow, hail, other things of that nature as well. Well, then it makes its way back to the ocean along different pathways. It can travel along the surface, such as just along streams and rivers. It can move in groundwater. It can move in a number of different ways, but it ultimately is driven by gravity, makes its way from high elevations back to the lowest elevation, the oceans or the seas. And so that's just the basic run-through of the hydrologic cycle. And like I said, we all kind of take it for granted because of how much we already know. But in ancient times, the ancients didn't understand it all that well. They didn't have the perspective we had. They didn't have meteorological studies. They didn't have a lot of the things that we really take for granted today. So I want to go through some of the history of this science and a little bit of the timeline, but mainly the development of the ideas, and especially show you how far-fetched some of the ideas were. You know, it all starts really in Greece. Greek philosophers kind of range from the period of 700 to 350 BC. And this is an important time because, as you'll recall, most of the Old Testament is recorded before this philosophical period is through. And so it's during, there's a little bit of overlap, but by the time the Old Testament is coming to its full culmination of its writings, the Greek philosophical period is really into high gear, and it comes to an end around 350 BC. And they were really mystified by caverns and springs. And the reason is, as you can see in some of these pictures behind here, is that really the geologic landscape is mainly limestone and marble. And it gets etched in a number of ways and reacts with acidified rainwater to the point that it creates what we call karst, or caves and caverns. And so they would see water interacting with these caves and caverns, and therefore, based on some of their mythology, they assumed there was an underworld. And that underworld was kind of a fanciful, but it was one that obviously steeped them into a lot of deeper thought and discussion. And so a lot of their ideas would surround this particular mythology. So they kind of mixed science and their religion together, and that's what kind of molded a lot of their ideas, and it certainly had a huge impact on the way they thought. Well, a number of Greek philosophers, I'm going to hit a couple of them and some of the high points that come out of their works to give you an idea of what they believed in this particular time. It all starts with Homer. He was just really an author and a poet, but he did have a huge impact on the Grecian world. And his writings were around the 8th century BC. He referred to a particular water body he referred to as Okeanos, from which we get our word today, ocean. He actually thought that the ocean was a mega river system that encircled the earth. And if you've ever been to Greece or even Italy and those places, if you haven't, I recommend you go. But you can see land masses just across water bodies. Even though it was expanses of ocean, you can see what you thought was just land on the other side. Sometimes it was just islands, sometimes it is other larger bodies, such as between the peninsulas of Greece and Italy. And because wind blows across it and the wave action looks and appears to give a direction of flow, it was assumed that was just one big, large river system that was just so expansive and big, it was hard to really fathom its size. And so he says in one of his particular works, he says, the enormous strengths of Okeanos, from whom all rivers and the entire sea and all springs and all deep wells have their waters. He even went on to talk about how clouds, he believed, dipped below the horizon to collect moisture from Okeanos. And so they thought that the clouds were interacting and interfacing with the ocean directly. And in fact, he even went so far as to say that the sun and the moon rise and set into its waters. Well, that certainly would appear to be the case if you're on one of these Grecian islands looking out over the expanse of the ocean, seeing the sun and the stars come up from one end and fall to the other. But he didn't understand, obviously, astronomy, didn't understand the rotation of the earth and how that appearance related to all the things, again, we take so much for granted today. Well, another individual comes along between 624 and 546 by the name of Thales. And Thales believed that water is the source of all things. He thinks all things come from water. He thinks water is really the source of life. And in fact, he even proposed something I think Tim will find interesting, is that he proposed that continents floated, and that they were just literally floating upon this giant ball of water. And that's kind of intriguing. He thinks everything, even including the continents, came from the water. All the animals, everything came from the water. And he even proposed this elaborate seawater filtration theory. It didn't have a lift mechanism, but supposedly, because they didn't understand capillary flow, supposedly like capillary flow, it would just upwell and flow up through the continents. And then that's why they would see springs come out of caverns or out of groundwater around the areas in Greece. And so he tried to connect some of those dots just based on these observations. They're a little elaborate, but sometimes you got to start out with a little bit of an artistic impression to ultimately get to something, because you got to have somewhere to start. Then an individual came along by the name of Anaxagoras, and he talks about the caverns of the earth are filled with water in continuous motion, resulting in the seas. It's just sloshing around inside the earth, and whenever it finally surges, it comes out, and that's where they got springs from. And that springs ultimately commingle to form streams and rivers, and that the groundwater, or the surface water, eventually seeps back deep into cavernous sources and into a massive reservoir. And so his thought was, is the ocean is just a surface piece of the component, but there was this vast underground water body from which all waters came from. Then came Plato. Plato we know very well, around 429 to 347 BC. He proposed that all terrestrial waters were sourced from what he called Tartarus, which was a vast subterranean cavern system. And it composed of, composed of numerous passages of various sizes and configuration deep within the Earth's system. And he even was quoted as saying, waters Water retires with a rush into the inner parts of the earth. It flows through subterranean channels and finds its way to several places, forming seas, lakes, rivers, and springs. So he thinks everything we see on the surface, on the continent at least, is ultimately sourced from deep within this Tartarian realm. And if you start to go into Greek philosophy, you'll start to understand it's the underworld too. Tartarus is associated where the place of the dead were and things like that. So in one particular mosaic, this is what he thought of as the earth. And in this particular system, you're actually seeing, and it appears to be, maybe something fiery here in the middle. I can't read the Latin from this particular piece. This is an ancient work from his. But ultimately, you have a heat source. You have all this cavernous water bodies deep within the earth. You have the ocean on the surface. You have wind blown. You can see the mythology starting to come into this. And then you can also see, here's the land masses. These are mountains, supposedly. And every one of them, you see this big gaping hole in them. And what he's proposing is that they're all hollow. And that's where the water gets upwelled, stored, and then pushed out onto the surface of the earth. That's just an example of Plato's work. Then comes Aristotle from 384 to 323, student of Plato. He says, it is thought that water gathers below the earth and flows from a great reservoir. That's what he was picking up from his teacher, Plato. He goes on to say, he says, we do not call water that flows a river, even if there is a great quantity of it, but only if the flow comes from a spring. And so it didn't matter how much precipitation would occur in a particular region. He just simply assumed, based on Plato and others all the way back to Homer, that this water has to come from some other source other than the ocean or precipitation. It has to come from under the earth. And then he also said the headwaters of rivers are found to flow from mountains, and from the greatest mountains there flows the most numerous and greatest rivers. So he saw a relationship. He thought the greatest rivers come from the greatest mountains, such as we saw in the illustration just a moment ago. He also proposed this idea. He says, it is unreasonable for anyone to refuse to admit that air becomes water. When he says that, he's not refuting the idea, he's actually supporting the idea. That air becomes water in the earth for the same reason it does above it. If the cold causes the vaporous air to condense into water above the earth, we must suppose the cold in the earth to produce the same effect. And so what he ultimately proposes, what's illustrated up here at the top, that somehow there is the idea under a void in them under a mountain, that it's kind of like what we would see condensating on that ice glass there, just ice water glass that we see up there illustrated, that supposedly the interaction of a human air like today and taking an ice glass outside, that cool condenses the water, it forms droplets, it's ultimately forming water. Well, that's not how water is formed in this particular environment in the hydrologic cycles we know today. But it was at least a unique thought, and I'm sure he associated with the humidity inside of caves and caverns with this particular idea, since he had seen it, observed it on the surface. Well, then comes another period of time, and the reason that the Grecian philosophical time comes to a quick and abrupt end, and then the Roman time picks up some time afterwards, is because there's a change in power in the world. The Greeks are overrun by the Romans. The Romans come into power as a world power, and then the center of philosophical views and the schools of thought move ultimately to Rome in Italy. And so what do? Well, just like they did with all the other things of Greece after conquering it, they stole them, and they just took them with them back to Rome. And so whether it was the edifices of the monuments or the statues or whatever the case was, they also took the literary works and they also took the schools of thought, and they started to build upon them. Well, there was a number of philosophers by the names of Lucretius, Vitruvius, Seneca being some of the main individuals, and they proposed a number of things. I won't go through all of them individually, but the culmination of their thoughts was this. Dew was newly created water released through the earth's pores. So kind of building on Aristotle's idea, there was water condensing, therefore you could see new droplets. They didn't understand that water already resided there in the atmosphere. It's the humidity we feel. That water is already in place. It's just merely condensing into a liquid. And so they assumed that dew in the morning, on a cool morning, it was ultimately new water being formed. It was created. Therefore, it's brand new. So what they proposed is it was an open system. Well, the earth is a closed system, meaning that there is no external inputs and there is no major loss. There can be changes of things, But in an open system, they believed things could continue to be created, and therefore water was constantly being created or having a new beginning. And so that was obviously wrong. But they also proposed that wind transported water to the clouds versus evaporation and transpiration. Transpiration being water that lifts after pretty much plants exhale. So the idea is that they thought wind would just whisk up the water on the earth, put it in the clouds, and it was just a subpart of this entire hydrologic cycle. But they didn't understand that actually that was a more important part, and in fact the wind transport wasn't necessarily the correct approach. And then they clearly stated in multiple cases, like Aristotle did, rain and snow were not sufficient for stream and river flow. There must be another source, and that's why they leaned upon the Tartarian view, that it has to be underneath the earth. And so there was a Greco subterranean view maintained all the way through Roman philosophy. Here's a particular example from Kircher's work in the 1600s. And as you can see here, this is a mountain supposedly from a cross-sectional view. You see a large water body underneath the mountain, and then you see some water artesianing or fountaining in the plains, and you see even a spring starting as a pond and making its way back to the ocean via stream. That was their view. Here's another example. Again, trying to figure out mechanisms for driving water. They see water going down into the system. And plummeting down here into some larger cavern, and supposedly water somehow is lifted by some kind of heat source, of which they did not understand. The deeper you go in the earth, the warmer it gets. So they obviously understood there had to be some relationship there. And then here's another one, and this comes from Kircher's work, and this is one of Kircher's own ideas, and he still was building on these ideas even in the 1600s. But here you see mountains that are hollow again. Water actually is coming up from whirlpools in the ocean. Of course, you know, how many observations of whirlpools did he see? Probably not many, if any at all. But he proposed that, like a bathtub, water went down in the ocean. These black conduits is water coming in from underneath the ocean. What's driving the lift, we don't know. But ultimately, they pop up as springs inside these mountains. And then all the water comes out of springs out of the mountains and flows back to the ocean. And as you can see, there's no other major river systems. It's all coming from springs, according to this particular view. Well, then comes an interesting time period called the Renaissance era in 1500 to 1700 AD. So now we're getting to just a few hundred years before our time. And scientists such as Leonardo da Vinci, of course, everybody thinks of him as an artist, but he also was a good observer as well and did some scientific work. There's Palissy, Perrault, Kircher, and Halley, whom was also Halley's Comet is named after. Well, these guys started to actually do some interesting things. Instead of just making observations, they started to go out and test things and measure things and try to come up with some scientific approach. This time period is called the Great Scientific Awakening because of this particular approach and the idea of using experimentation and calculation versus just the observations. And so through those processes, the modern theory finally takes shape. And it starts with a number of individuals such as Pierre Perrault, who goes out to the Seine River near Paris, and he goes out and he calculates how big an area, ultimately all the water in a particular basin, flows into the Seine River. And then he would get an idea of how much rainfall occurred there during an annual time period, and then he would calculate by volume how much water should that be to estimate if that's how much water is coming down the Seine River and passing through Paris. Well, he takes those calculations and he estimates the number, and what he finds out, which just blows his mind, is three times more water that flows down the Seine River, the only upland water sources come through, was actually the rainfall was three times the flow, meaning actually two-thirds of it was either evaporating back into the atmosphere or going into groundwater. And so only one-third of it was making it down the river. And whereas Aristotle and others said there's no way rainfall can account for all of the flow of our rivers, actually Pierre Perrault proved without a doubt that actually there's more rainfall that occurs than even the rivers flow. And so it was a very intriguing scenario. And then they had to step into meteorological observations to figure out, well, how does water get into the atmosphere to begin with, and what's its ultimate reservoir or source? And that's when they figured out it was the ocean, not necessarily some underground cavern or cave system such as proposed by the Greeks. And so that's how we got to the water cycle. And I know that's a lot of information thrown at you all at once, but it's just to give you an appreciation of how bad scientists had it in the past and how recently it has been that they finally got it right and how far out in the left field they went before they actually got on the right track. Well, now the comparison. What does the Bible have to say about it, and how old are some of those writings? Well, as I said, a lot of the writings of the Old Testament were already complete before really the height of the Greco philosophical time period. And so a lot of the science that was done and the scientists' views and opinions actually come after the biblical time for the most part. And so let's see what the Bible has to say long ago. Well, the first verse I want to share with you is Ecclesiastes 1:7, which says, "All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again." Here the ecclesiastical writer, Solomon, says that ultimately rivers run into the sea, yet it is not full. Now, first of all, even if the world was a open system and there was newly created water, the ocean is so big and the water volume flowing into it, even though it's massive, is really minute in comparison. And we'll see a picture towards the end to show just how much water covers the earth. You know, if you were having brand new water flowing into the ocean all the time, filling it like a bathtub, it would take years before you'd even see that ocean raise 1 inch. It would take years. And it's just a huge volume of water. And that's what the ancients couldn't understand, is just how big a reservoir the ocean truly was. But even though it says that this is a closed system, or infers a closed system because the ocean is never filling or full, it says, "To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again." Now, to me, it's quite clear that it's talking about the ocean as the context of this passage. Therefore, the ocean is the source. But some people have quoted this passage, even in ancient times, out of context, and said, well, what it's inferring is it's through the subterranean source. Well, we know that's not true, and that's purely inferred and injected. But the Bible doesn't say that. But let's go to some other passages, and let's see what they have to say. And so here's the proposed, the alternative hypothesis, as we saw, see it diagrammed up here, even though we know that's not true. So here's Amos chapter 5 and verse 8. Amos records, "He calls for the waters of the sea and pours them out on the face of the earth. The Lord is his name." And Amos 9:6, he says it almost verbatim, but he adds a little bit more information here for color. He says, "He who builds his layers in the sky and has founded his strata in the earth, who calls for the waters of the sea and pours them out on the face of the earth, the Lord is his name." So Amos is quite clear that the waters poured out on the earth, or literally descending from above, are waters that ultimately are sourced from the ocean, the sea. And that's important to note, because Amos has it right and the ancients had it completely wrong. They had the wrong source. They thought it was subterranean. But Amos has it right, and he says that ultimately, and gives credit that it is God whom has the ability to do this. It is according to his works. It is according to his design. He says it pours them. He pours them out on the face of the earth. And it's interesting to note there in that verse, chapter 9, verse 6, there below, he says, he even talks about there, he builds layers in the sky. So not only does he have the source right, but he talks about a meteorological aspect that really wasn't appreciated until much later. The idea that the sky, like the stratum below, as even mentioned there, is layered. Well, how would anyone know that the sky is layered, or even that the earth beneath is layered? I know from the earth beneath, as Tim and I both know from geology, is that you gotta drill some wells to know how layered the earth is, unless you do a huge, massive regional geology study. Well, geology didn't become a science for the last few hundred years. So that study wasn't ever taking place. But how do you understand that the sky has layers in it? Today, we understand it and appreciate that the sky has layers. And in fact, we know most of the names of the different cloud formations and the different layers that are associated with it. Whether it be the cumulus clouds that we're so familiar with, or stratus clouds, or even the extremely high elevation cirrus clouds. You know, those things are definitely in different layers. And until we actually got into aircraft and balloons, and or could ascend mountains to really high elevations, you couldn't appreciate that. Because from our perspective below, yes, you can see clouds moving in contrast to one another and seeming to be layered, but you can't see the layers from the earthen perspective. And so he had that right. And Amos is accredited with a lot of that information, and very accurately so. How about Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 13, which is also verbatim in 51 and 16, and then quoted again, initially a quote from Psalms 135 and 7. Jeremiah says, "When he utters his voice, there is a multitude of waters in the heavens. And he causes the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth. He makes lightning for the rain. He brings the wind out of his treasuries." So again, we're speaking about God here, Jeremiah using the he here, denoting God in the earlier context of this passage. And it says here that when he utters his voice, there is a multitude of waters in the heavens. Now, let me share with you just some information from the word study I did on this particular passage, because it is intriguing to me how much information is kind of hidden here in the Hebrew that doesn't come out necessarily or clearly in the English. When he says here, he utters, it is speaking of God, also translated as he makes or he gives. That can also be a proper translation. And the word for voice there is also translated elsewhere in the Bible from its original Hebrew as simply a sound, such as with a trumpet. I'm getting ahead of myself, hitting slides, but you can look at that picture, I don't mind. As a trumpet, such as found in Joshua 6 and 5. A noise, such as a great assembly of people crying out at once, this is in 1 Samuel 4 and 14. And thunder, as related to the sound associated with lightning in Exodus 19, verse 16, which often accompanies what? Hail and rain during severe thunderstorms, as noted in Exodus 9 and verse 34. And so, the idea here that's kind of intriguing to me is that when we look at this phrase and we transliterate it based on its use elsewhere and not just from an English modern perspective looking back in the translation, it can also be transliterated as when he makes the sound of thunder, there is a vast amount of water stored in the sky above. That could also be accurately stated. And so to me, it's as we know today, whether you're in Texas, Oklahoma, Missouri, wherever you live, when you hear thunder, you know there's a possibility of what? Rain. You know the rain is coming. Well, that's exactly what this verse is trying to state, is that there is the possibility of rain. But what's interesting is that he mentions that there is a multitude of waters. A multitude, literally a massive amount, also translated a great store, as in 2 Chronicles chapter 31 and verse 10. And the interesting thing about that word is being a store or storage or storehouse is also found in the Old Testament, is it's a vast amount. It's a vast amount. And when we look up at the clouds, and from the ancient's perspective, they just didn't think to them that there could be a massive amount of water up there in the clouds. And so they would have had no capacity to understand and appreciate just how much the atmosphere can store as far as water. We'll see again a picture here in just a little bit that's going to show that very clearly. But when we hear thunder, we obviously know that God is going to bring forth a lot of rain, just like in this picture, a wall of rain that comes down in a torrential downpour. Well, how about Job 36, verse 27 and 28? Here the Bible says, "For he draws up drops of water, which distill as rain from the mist, which the clouds drop down and pour abundantly on man." Now, this verse can cause some problems, and for a couple of reasons that I'll share with you here this afternoon. This verse here, at first glance, doesn't appear to be problematic until you look at the word drop, the word for drops of water, and also for the word there, distill. Now, when you get into diving into understanding these particular words, you kind of go back to the Aristotelian view. And the Aristotelian view was kind of like this. It was that heat and cooling of moisture that's in the atmosphere ultimately can condense and create drops of water. Well, the distillation process is certainly one that purifies water and which you can get water from. But it's not how our atmosphere works at all. In fact, in the next verse, I'll show you how our atmosphere works. But without going into all of the science here, this is problematic because this is not right if you take it at face value. The distillation process is not how clouds work. There is no cold surface for which water droplets form and then fall from the sky. There's another process in place. But here's how you deal with this verse. And this is something that's easy to do when dealing with individuals. There's just another example of how it might also work from hot springs. But again, it's not all hot springs all over the world. But when you deal with people that take or look at this verse from a superficial standpoint, who are not Bible scholars, in fact, not even Bible believers, and want to attack the Bible, there's one thing a non-Bible believer, understands that you do. Context, context, context. We have to read the Bible in its context. You can't just take a writing out of the book and say, that has to be a statement of fact, therefore, if it's wrong, then the Bible's wrong. No, you have to consider the source of the statement. In this particular case, the individual speaking here is not God. It is not Job. It's one of Job's three friends. And in fact, it's a young man by the name of Elihu. And I would propose to you that Elihu, who is speaking here, is not inspired, but is in fact mixing partial truths with partial lie. And let me show you why I believe that to be the case. First of all, in Job 32, verse 6, he's identified as a young man. And a few verses later, verses 10 and 17, he clearly states he is sharing with his friends his opinion. He's also admitting that there are some things he did not know in verse 22 of chapter 32. And he spoke words from his heart, chapter 33 and verse 3. He claimed to have perfect knowledge, 36 and 4, and presumed to speak on God's behalf in 36 verse 2. However, and this is the part where we know he's not a valuable source of information, he stated he had no sin, chapter 33 and verse 9, thus making him a liar, according to 1 John chapter 1 and verse 8, where it says, he who says he has no sin is a liar. So, does he have some facts right? Well, of course, he probably has some facts right. Just like some people may have certain facts right when they tell you a story about something they really don't understand. They've heard a few things, so they pick up on some of the things that they do know, but it's mixed with things they don't know. And what happens? Well, you get just a little bit of truth mixed with a little bit of error. The whole thing ends up being error. And so you can't actually quote that particular source. And so at the end of the day, the distillation process is wrong. The process really is evaporation, which I'll share with you here in this next passage. So Psalm 19, verses 4 and 6, the psalmist says, in the heavens he has set a tabernacle for the sun, which is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, and rejoices like a strong man to run its race. Its rising is from one end of heaven, and its circuit to the other end, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. Now I don't want to go into the astronomy part of this passage, but I do want to notice at least one particular thing, and it's a very important thing when it comes to the hydrologic cycle, and that's what's the driver of the hydrologic cycle. And what it is it's the heat of the sun is mentioned here. The thing is that understanding the sun, or this heavenly body designed by God to create light, according to Genesis 1, verse 16, that rises and sets in the sky from our human perspective here on earth, that it has, as it says here, heat. And the heat, as we find in the Old Testament, the only time this word is found as heat in the Old Testament is here. But we do find alternatives of this word, often referenced to the idea of sun or something that has a warming or heating effect. Thus, the word is reserved for the sun, but specifically related to the heat and the warmth in which it provides. Now, this is interesting, since early philosophers didn't begin to hypothesize that the heat we feel on Earth during the day is ultimately sourced from the sun. Let me rephrase that. Philosophers didn't begin to hypothesize that the heat we feel is from the sun until after the Old Testament was completely written. It wasn't until after that period that they actually started to propose that the sun could be a heat source. It was Anaxagoras, who we noted earlier, who lived in Athens, Greece, around 450 BC, that thought that the sun and the stars were fiery stones in the sky that emanated heat, and all but the sun were too far away for their heat to be felt. However, his ideas were met with disapproval, and he was finally imprisoned for piety for introducing sinful ideas of heresy. And others in astronomy have faced similar situations, such as Galileo, Aristarchus, and others. But it wasn't until the 19th century, literally one century or two centuries ago, that science proved heat to be an energy. It was actually found to be radiation. And so therefore, when we talk about solar heat, we're talking about solar radiation, sourced from the sun, and that it is the ultimate driver of the hydrologic cycle, causing water molecules to volatilize, such as I'll illustrate here. Here's the sun, here's the solar radiation, to volatilize and evaporate water, which is the driving force of the hydrologic cycle and drives the winds, it drives the response from water molecules. And what's interesting about it is without solar radiation, water doesn't necessarily want to escape. It actually has a bonding property called hydrophilic bond, and that water molecules have a slight charge that they all want to be together. That's why you can pour it out on the flat surface and it'll all puddle. It won't just spread out and disappear. It wants to puddle and stay together in drops and also in these puddle forms. But to break those bonds, you have to actually excite the electrons and the molecules to actually break the bond and for these H2O molecules to want to escape from the presence of the other water body. So without solar radiation, you can't have the process. But also, solar radiation wasn't appreciated until the 19th century. And so Amos and in this case, the psalmist had it right long, long before man ever even anticipated what this process was. So here's another verse, Job 26 and 8, speaking of God again. He binds up the water in his thick clouds, yet the clouds are not broken under it. So we see clouds all the time. We see how obviously they start to form on a day like today. They're obviously forming quite rapidly since last night to today. We've got quite overcast skies, such as in this case. It's a lot of water being stored up in the atmosphere above, as the writer here in Job states. But yet, it doesn't just necessarily mean that once it builds up that it just falls. Well, it has to hit a tipping point. It has to find a certain catalyst point at which it will ultimately release the water. Well, that's talked about in some other verses. For instance, Ecclesiastes 11:3 says, if the clouds are full of rain or reach their capacity, they empty themselves upon the earth. And we see that all the time. And so, even though it's a very simple statement, the statement is accurate. Which obviously identifies that clouds do have a certain level of capacity. It does reach a maximum capacity before release. The psalmist in Psalm 65, verse 9, speaking of God, you visit the earth and water it. You greatly enrich it. The river of God is full of water. You know, from this verse here, there's something that I want us to appreciate, is that at the end of the day, the water cycle has a purpose. It actually has a purpose. It's a life-supporting purpose. If we don't have water cycling on the earth, if we don't have rains that come at the time we need them, the certain seasons and the certain amounts throughout the year, life is not going to exist. You become a desert location and suddenly life disappears and it's not near as abundant as it once was. Well, the whole purpose of the water cycle is to sustain life. And you know, it starts the entire process by which all things are living, and especially God's created us. And if we don't have this water cycle in place and working and designed by God, our ability to thrive and survive is really very limited. And so from the very beginning, as it says here by the psalmist, the earth is enriched, and we are enriched obviously as a product of the earth because God has this water cycle in place. And certainly we appreciate it today. The Deuteronomy writer in Deuteronomy 8 and 7 says, for the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water and fountains and springs that flow out of valleys and hills. So the writer here talks about an aspect of the water cycle, and for time's sake, I can't go into it, but I want to show you the purpose behind it. The purpose behind it really, as even here it says, actually I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit, but Psalm 104, verse 10, he sends the springs into the valleys, they flow among the hills. This is really talking about the groundwater portion of water flow. What I meant to say is, and again, if you want the science, I'll give you the science later. No time for that. Anyway, coming back to the Ecclesiastes, so scratch that last passage, or that last thought I started. I'm going to finish it here in the next slide or two. So the Ecclesiastes 1 and 7. Let's come back full round to the verse we started with here, and then we'll hit a few closing points, and we'll bring our lesson to a close. In Ecclesiastes 1 and 7, it says, "All the rivers run to the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again." So no matter how magnificent a river system may be, whether it's the Mississippi, whether it be smaller river systems in the local regions such as we know today, whether it be the Nile and the Euphrates or whatever, the bottom line is they ultimately come from and originate from and make their way back to the ocean. The Bible always had that right. And in all these verses we've seen, especially the Amos passages, it's clear that the ocean was intended to be this ultimate reservoir. It was the place from which all the waters were going to come from. And what the ancients didn't understand is just how much water there is out there. And until you've flown over the ocean, do you even begin to get some kind of aspect of how much water there is? If you fly from Dallas today over to the East Coast or the West Coast, and you think to yourself how long that flight is, if you haven't been overseas, you don't know what a long flight is yet. But when you fly over that magnificent ocean, you start to appreciate just how big a body of water that is. And what you don't appreciate is how deep it is at times, too. So the volume is massive. And all the blue in that picture is representing water in the ocean. But why can't you see all that blue? It's called that white. It's called clouds. That's water in motion, drawn up into the atmosphere, making its way to the lands. And ultimately, as every one of those little storm systems that are coming in from west to east across the United States are spinning off in our oceans, making their way landward, they're bringing us water. And they're sustaining this entire water cycle. But what's interesting is, of all the passages in the entire scriptures, there's not one passage at all about the idea of a cavernous or subterranean reservoir, such as what the ancients proposed from philosophical days. You won't find one. You see, in fact, cavern is not even used in the Bible. The word cave is, but it's only for the habitation of man who was looking for places to live in the mountains. Never is it a source of water, or is it talked about in the groundwater sense. And so that too is a standout piece. The Bible never, ever goes along with the ideas that were proposed back in the ancient days. So the psalmist says in Psalm 65 and verse 9, "You visit the earth and you water it. You greatly enrich it. The river of God is full of water. You provide their grain, for so you prepared it." And so there's a little bit more to that verse that we didn't notice earlier. But the idea that it provides the grain, it provides food, it provides sustenance. But Isaiah 30 verse 23 also says that he will give the rain for your seed, with which you sow the ground, and the bread of the increase of the earth. It will be fat and plentiful, and that day your cattle will feed in large pastures. So it's not only to sustain life, but as I said, God has us in mind, his created. Those created in the image of God need to have a sustainment of life. And so he created this so that we might have a life source for all the things we need. Two things we need. We need food, and we need water. And water is the one that is most critical that you can't go without for a very long period of time. Isaiah says in Isaiah 55, 10 and 11, "For as the rain comes down and the snow from heaven and do not return there, but water the earth and make it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater." So that again goes along and supports what we've been noting. But here's the rest of that passage. And here's an important one. "So shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me void, but it shall accomplish what I please, and it shall prosper in the thing for which I sent it." At the end of the day, not only does God have a purpose for the water cycle, but his word has a purpose. And it's interesting that here in Isaiah, he would take the time to show the comparison of the two ideas. That even though this water cycle is something to appreciate, what he really wants you to appreciate is, as it has a purpose, his word has a purpose. It's to educate. It's to hopefully cause one to reflect upon their relationship with God. And hopefully one that convinces and convicts a person that they need a relationship with God, for he is the one who will save. He's the one that gave his son. He's the one that gave a plan of salvation, that man may be restored to having a relationship with him. And if we don't appreciate that and put it into place, then that which he sent doesn't purpose as he intended because we deny it and we pass it up, just as if we would withhold eating or drinking. Romans 1 and 20, there Paul said, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen." So there are some things in these processes that we can't necessarily see, but we certainly can appreciate them, and there are certainly things we can't even go out and scientifically examine, such as origins. But we can look at some of these things, such as this hydrologic cycle, and go, you know, the Bible had it right. Why did man have it so wrong? Well, because the Bible had something that man never had: inspiration. It came from God. It came from the Creator. It came from the one that designed it. The designer passed along some of the blueprints. It wasn't intended to enlighten us on the hydrologic cycle, but that when we understood the hydrologic cycle and looked back, we would appreciate that the author was there all the while. Psalm 19, verse 1, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmaments show his handiwork." There, obviously, is speaking of the heavens above as declaring the glory of God, but that word firmament is also the word used for sky and atmosphere. What are we talking about? The hydrologic cycle. Most of it takes place in the sky and the atmosphere. Yeah, there are some parts that are physical we see on the ground, but most of that cycle takes place above us as far as the invisible conveyor belt. And what does he says? When we came to understand it and appreciate it, he says it shows his handiwork, shows his creative ability, and just how grand a planner he really was. So if you put the hydrologic cycle together, such as we saw in that USGS figure earlier, and we throw the scriptures all up there, what do we find? Amazingly, the Bible is quite detailed about the aspects and the parts of the hydrologic cycle, and that there's verses talking about them and talking about them most accurately. And therefore, you start to look at the whole of this picture and you say to yourself, you know, had it been just one or two pieces of it, that might just have been happen chance. But since the Bible shows so many of the intricate pieces and of the details that it shows, it's certainly no accident. Again, it speaks of the handiwork of God. I leave you with this slide. Aristotle said, "No theory has been handed down to us that the most ordinary man could not have thought of." Aristotle was convinced that man was going to be able to figure out everything. And that by the time Aristotle came on the scene during towards the end of the Greek philosophical period, he thought they'd already figured out everything there was to figure out. Well, I think Aristotle would be blown away with things like PowerPoint, air conditioning, other things too. There's things we've learned over the years. But what he does is he puts into scope that human beings have the ability to understand everything. And what he didn't appreciate is he himself didn't understand this cycle that he wrote so animately about. But you know what else another writer said? And I love this one in contrast. "For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." Isaiah 55 and 9. That's God. God, in contrast to man, obviously knows far more than we can appreciate. And when we get a glimpse of that, especially here as we noted here in the scriptures, the whole point of it is to instill faith. To instill faith so that we would be convinced and then convicted that God is the creator. And that God created all the things we've seen, including this hydrologic cycle. But most importantly, we understand that there's a purpose behind his word. And we find that application and we put it to use in our lives. That brings our lesson to a close this afternoon. I hope this presentation has been helpful to you, especially in your faith, and I hope it'll be something you'll contemplate. We don't like to close a lesson without offering people the opportunity to obey the gospel. If you are one